You are listening to the Myth TV Cast. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Myth TV Cast. My name is Pat DeVille, and with me on the phone is my co-host, Dan Fry.
How's it going, Pat?
I can't complain, man. It's been too long.
Yeah. This will be, take two.
Yeah, actually, what happened was we had a couple of the Mythbuntu developers on last week, John Bebb and Nick Fox, and what happened was we had problems with the asterisk box. It wasn't up for, like, most of the day. And then, so last minute thing, you suggested we try Google Voice, right?
Right.
And Google Voice lets you do...
And it would have worked, too. It would work, too, had we done everything in the right order.
Yeah, well, but it was the first time we ever tried anything like that. And we tried the...
Yeah.
You can record the calls, but you got to, like, you got to do it after everybody's on the call. Otherwise, it stops recording when somebody else joins in. It's pretty weird.
Right.
But anyway...
Yeah, once I joined everybody into the call, then I needed to restart the recording again, and that should have handled it, but we didn't quite get it down bad the first time.
Yeah, you know, live and learn, you know? What are you going to do? Make mistakes,
yep.
Move on.
In a pinch, if you want to record a podcast, by all means, have somebody sign up for Google Voice and record the call. You get an MP3 out of it.
Seriously, I don't know what the hell the deal was, man. So, like I said, anyway. So... Do you have any big news since the last time we talked? It's been a while. So I can't even remember.
I finally got my Ion front end up and running now correctly. So I decided to abandon wireless altogether inside the system, and I picked up a wireless bridge, a wireless N bridge to handle streaming all the HD content over to the Ion box, and I tell you what, it's working really good. I don't notice any issues with standard definition, but maybe at about like a 20-minute mark on like a half hour or an hour HD recording, I get like a little stutter. I assume it's just buffering, but otherwise it plays fine. I mean I'm not putting it on a high def screen at this point, but it seems to play just fine with through the Sewell VGA to RCA converter, and it looks nice. And actually this old TV that's sitting there, I mean, it really looks nice on that, that tiny screen.
How much did the wireless bridge run you?
It was $59.
That's not bad at all. Newegg.
There's my router that I... Yeah, no, it's not. My router was a TrendNet router. It was a wireless N router, so it can either do wireless N at 5 gigahertz or wireless N at 2.4 gigahertz. Something else I found out about wireless N, too, is it only supports... WPA encryption. I can't, unfortunately, do that in the house here because I have like my printer. My wife still has a TiVo, that has a wireless access to it as well, which doesn't support WPA. Only supports WEP. And you can, if you run a wireless end device with WEP encryption on it, you basically knock it down to a BG connection.
Well, that's useless.
So that's something to keep in mind for people. Yeah, something to keep in mind for people. You can try and go the concurrent dual band ones, which I thought I was going to do at one point, but they don't seem to come with the gigabit routers in them yet. So for anything that's hooked up locally to it, they were only giving you 100 megabit connections. So I decided to go with the wireless N only router, and then I get the wireless bridge, which it works really nice. And that device actually can either you can turn it into a wireless distribution access point. So it basically turns it into a wireless access point that does not need to be connected by a hard line to the router itself. So it's called WDS, I believe, wireless distribution system.
That's
or you can
good.
Make it into a bridge, or you can make it into a what's the other? There's just a like almost kind of like an ad hoc kind of like client, so you could hook two of them up together to like an existing router, you know, just regular router, and it would give you the Wi-Fi access as well. So it's pretty nice. I'm actually considering getting another one or two of them and just setting up those WDS endpoints so that I can put the full coverage over my house. Now, I shouldn't have that issue being that I just live in a townhouse, but with all of the, you know, interference and whatnot from the neighbors, I think it might, you know, be better off in the long run.
You know,
working out really nicely.
When I was using the Hophog Media MVP, which is that small little embedded box that was standard def only, and it had like the MPEG-2 decoder on it, I used it with a wireless bridge, and it worked great for standard def stuff with the wireless G.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is the same kind of idea, I guess, and I'm glad it's working out for you, because you had like it was driving you crazy that wireless dongle that was on there. And if you read around,
it was. I went through two mini PCI Express cards trying to get it to work, and I could get it connected where down here in the basement where my wireless router is. As soon as I took it upstairs, I got no connection whatsoever. So now I decided to abandon the internal hardware altogether and just go with the hardware, you know, external router or bridge, and that seems to solve the problem just fine for me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's working out for you though. So, and you're enjoying your little box there?
I am. It's nice. You'll have to check this box out. It's a pretty sweet little device. It can do, you know, full DVD, you know, playback if you want to. It's got a 30 gig solid state drive in it, so the thing boots up in like 4 seconds, and that's not even a joke. It is really fast, and it pulls all the content, music, photos, you know, all the content wirelessly, and it plays it just fine on that little screen. One of the next things I'm going to do is get another TV for up there, so hopefully that'll be a nice, you know, flat screen, maybe, you know, it doesn't have to be real big, because it's just a small area in our sunroom where we happen to have another TV, you know, right off of our kitchen, and so I'm looking for just, you know, something small enough with an HDMI connection that I can just, you know, feed all of that out to it. All that content out onto it.
Cool. Well, my news is the wife has given me approval to go looking for an HDTV for my family room, which is the
nice.
Off the kitchen on the first floor. And I'm looking 40 to 42 inch range. I'm not opposed to LCD or plasma. I started looking around, and the one that jumped out at me, they had a sale on this one Panasonic plasma. It was the 42 inch one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 1080, you know, obviously I'm looking for 1080p, and it was selling for like $7.
Right.
Sears had it this week. A couple of the other places had it too. And I kind of liked that then. I kind of wanted to get that. And I took my wife we just went to the Best Buy over here that opened up. And she kind of liked the LCDs a little more, honestly. You know, she said, you know, they looked a little brighter. So I'm kind of leaning, if I go the LCD route, I'm kind of leaning towards the a Samsung, 40-inch Samsung, which is a very nice TV.
Okay.
Now, I looked at like some of the differences between 60 hertz LCDs, 120 hertz LCDs, and 240 hertz LCDs.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the difference between 60 and 120 is negligible. I can't see that much of a difference between
them.
Right. Now, obviously, when you go into these outlet stores, they, you know, it all depends on what kind of feed they're putting in. At least Best Buy, they have a 720p feed going through on most of their TVs all the time, unless it's hooked up to a Blu-ray player, which you'll get the full 1080p. Same kind of deal when you go into like Sears.
Right.
And that's the only other thing. For instance, I went to this other store that's near my office, that's prevalent in New Jersey, 67 Electronics, and they had a DirecTV, it looked like a 720p feed, but it looked like absolute crap, man. It was all compressed. It didn't look so bad if it was a 720p set, but on the 1080p TVs, man, you would see like all sorts of like artifacting and compression and pixelization in the corners. I thought it looked like absolute shit. I think the cable that we get currently is a better quality HD signal than what they're getting. If that's typical for DirecTV HD, I think it's absolute crap. So I don't know if it was just a case of the way they had it set up there. So if somebody has DirecTV and they have HD, and they're going to a decent sized 1080p TV set, say 40 inches or bigger, and there's no compression and no pixelization, let me know. I'm curious. So So out of the LCDs, people, you know, I've talked to a few people. There's one dude in my office. He's kind of like an audiophile kind of, and he's into video. He's really into the video stuff. This guy, he bought, you know, an HD DVD player and a Blu-ray player, you know, 5 years ago. You know what I'm saying? So he's right. Really, he's really into, like, you know, the whole home video stuff. And he was saying that, you know, the Samsung LCDs are really good. The Sony's are very nice. You know, Panasonic makes nice plasmas. Samsung makes also makes plasmas, but I was looking around, and it seems that their plasmas are only 720p's. And there's not a lot of manufacturers doing plasma. Now, plasma has this stigma that it's it uses up more energy than an LCD. That is true, but the newer generation plasmas, it's not that much of a difference between an LCD and a plasma. For instance, I had this article I read on CNET. I'll post it in the show notes, where they did a full comparison of different size TVs, LCD and plasma. And usually, the one size range I'm looking at, 42-inch range, they're saying that the plasmas, the current generation of plasmas on in a typical year, I think you'd spend maybe $15 more in electricity than what an LCD. You know, $15 over an entire year is not that much. You know, some people, you know, that's a big deal to them.
No, not really.
I know out in California they pretty much ban plasmas. I think that's a little knee jerk reaction on their part. You know, but whatever. That's California for you. I know. Go ahead.
I was gonna say so the. You said Panasonic makes the plasmas, but they only do 720p.
Samsung also does plasmas, and I couldn't find.
Samsung.
I couldn't find anything, you know, better than 720p. But Samsung's Panasonic does the full 1080p.
Right.
And I thought they're nice TVs.
Right.
You know, if you look at like the if you compare like the plasmas and the LCDs, the plasmas tend to look a little brighter, but I think the color tones on the plasma tend to be a little more realistic, and. You know, like with LCDs,
right.
I mean, there's pluses and minuses. Another thing with LCDs, you tend to, whatever, you know, angle you tend to view it at, you know, the sharper the angle, the less, it's not going to look as good. Where I think with the plasma, that's less of an issue. I think the viewing angles, it's you can go a little further out and it looks fine. So it's just different things to compare and contrast, you know. So, you know, you got to weigh out the advantages and the disadvantages to both. And whatever you decide, that's what you go with. So if I do go with an LCD, I'm kind of leaning towards a Samsung. Now, going from a 60 hertz to 120 hertz LCD, I didn't see that much of a difference. But going from a 120 to a 240, I think it was much, much more noticeable. The difference between going up in that range, though, is, you know, you're tagging on like $100 to $200, depending on which make and model you tend to get.
Right.
You know, so if I do get the LCD, I'm probably just going to get a 60 hertz LCD and be done with it. Or go with a plasma, you know. That's where I'm going. One of those two. Mm-hmm. Now, I saw it. What was really amazing, they have these OLED TVs now. Holy cow. Those TVs just look absolutely kick-ass, man. The picture quality is stunning on them.
I'll stop in and check some of them
out. Oh, man. They look freaking phenomenal, man. OLEDs, man. They're going to be the standard in like another 2-3 years probably. You know, not even.
They're real thin, too, right?
Oh, they're super thin. They're super light, and the quality is just absolutely kick-ass. Blows LCD or plasma away. You know, it just looks phenomenal. They're expensive now, you know? For say, if you were going to get an LCD that was like 40, 42 inches, you'd spend in the neighborhood of $700 to $750 or so. When an OLED, you're probably looking at like, you know, $1,500, $1,400 in that range. So it's pretty much like double the price, you know? So give it time. You'll see those TV prices. They'll come down, the OLEDs. And they look absolutely stunning.
Right.
Now, I didn't see any 3D TVs in the stores yet. So I think, I don't know if it was Panasonic.
Are they going to be out yet? Because, I mean, they're only just starting to kind of announce those. So I'm not sure if we'll see any of them around here.
I think Sony or Panasonic, one of the two, they have a hard date. And I think it's in the springtime. I think it's like April or May. They announced the model that's going to be available. Now, what's annoying about that whole 3D TV thing is you got to wear glasses, man. I don't see myself sitting in my living room with a pair of 3D glasses watching freaking TV. I'm sorry. It's one thing going into a movie theater and doing that once in a blue moon, but like sitting there watching TV every day, I just don't see it happen.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's going to have to be something that changes, I think. You know, something new that's going to allow this to more or less come to life in a sense, you know, and I don't see that happening in anywhere in the near future. Maybe 10, 20 years down the line, something like that.
Supposedly, it might
nothing right now.
It might be sooner than that. I read an article somewhere that was, I forget which company it was, they had a technology where they were able to do 3D without glasses, but it's kind of like early stages. So who knows how long that's going to take until that's actually,
right,
you know, mature and be and able to be, you know, put in a consumer electronics, you know, device. So we'll see. Honestly, I think it's a gimmick. You know, I may be wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe all these other people are right. Who knows?
Some stations are starting to record it, at least. Like, I think, what did I say, ESPN is starting to record it in 3D so that when the TV sets are available, you'll be able to go to, like, a special channel and it'll be broadcast in there.
Well, the World Cup is coming up this summer, and I believe they're going to be airing some of the games in 3D. But, you know, who the hell's going to have the TV?
Yeah.
That's the thing, you know.
Right, right.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, if a bear farts in the woods and there's nobody around here, did the bear really fart in the woods?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that, you know. But some other things. Well, Nick's supposed to join us at some point tonight. But John Babb wasn't.
Yeah, actually, he's telling me. Unfortunately, he's traveling tonight. But he did mention to me now that it looks like Mario, who is the originator of the Mythbooku project, is going to jump on, as well as they have one other person. So they might all be joining on here in just a minute or so.
Well, we need to know because the Astros box can only handle two real phone connections, POTS connections. So if they're all calling in regular phone.
Yeah, I'm sending them. I'm sending them the other thing now.
Yeah, the SIP IP address information. So there's more than two of them, you know, coming in. Well, if you're coming in through a POTS connection, so we can only handle one other one. So
yeah, I would have to jump off and try and get on.
But you've done that before, haven't you? With your Nokia.
I have, but it wasn't working. It was requiring a password the last time I tried to get on with it.
Yeah, well, we had the conversation with Nick and John last week that it was lost. And one of the things, you know, the last episode we talked about updates. And one of the listeners had a question, you know, whether or not they should, you know, besides whatever comes down through the regular repos, you know, what other updates should they be doing? And my initial statement was that if it's not broke, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it, was my initial. And John came back and he basically said that, you know, Mythbuntu shipped with a pre-release of 0.22 and there was a bunch of updates and packages that are coming down the pike. And what he did was he referred us to the Mythbuntu page where you can go in and you can enable the nightly auto build service. Okay, and when you go in and do that, there's two selections, 0.22 and 0.23. You're going to want to select 0.22 because that's what the current is. So what it is you go in there and you download this little package, just a little Debian package, you know, Ubuntu package. And you click on that, it'll install, and it'll enable the testing repos. And it'll ask you what you want, 0.22 or 0.23. Select 0.22. And then you can do your updates. And that'll pull down quite a bit of updates through there. In fact, it'll do all the myth packages will be updated through that. Now, there was also another issue where when I did that initially, I didn't check NUVExport. And one of our listeners, he sent us an email. He said he did the auto builds and I said on my blog I posted that I had done this and everything seemed to be working okay. He did this and he reported that NUVExport was busted. And that was rather unfortunate. So I know.
Okay.
John was the main writer of MythExport. That's the package, right? MythExport, Dan.
Yes, MythExport. Yep.
Right, and when you enable 0.22 and you try to install MythExport, it barfs some kind of dependency issue. So when we spoke to John last week, he said that we should also enable the PPA repo. And once I did that, I tried installing MythExport and it installed okay. And I got that working and that works pretty well. You know, it's got, you know, it adds an extra little thing inside of MythWeb where you can go in and you can, you know, set jobs up. There's a whole bunch of presets for like all different handheld devices in there.
Sure.
and you could select one of the presets, or you can do your own custom one. And I've been playing around with that, and that works pretty good. You know, it's pretty nice.
Did you get a good one made up for your Android phone?
You know, I got a good setting. I was talking to a couple different people. I was talking to Patrick Archibald, who I know on Identica. I've emailed him. He listens to the show, too, and he's a Myth user. I think he's down in South Carolina. And he had sent me a straight command line FFmpeg to do to Nokia. And he had, I think he had the Droid. So he had the higher resolution setting. I set it to the lower resolution, and it worked pretty well. And so that's just using a command that's just using a straight line FFmpeg command. Now, Alan Metzler from the Tech Show, he also has a Droid. And he was using Handbrake GTK. You know, with Handbrake GTK, that's a GUI application to, you know, rip DVDs and whatnot. But you can also, there's also a command line interface. He had sent me a script to use the command line interface for Handbrake. And that worked pretty well, too, you know. The only caveat to that is you have to have Handbrake installed on your system. So both of those methods, both of those methods created good videos that you can put on an Android phone, either a lower resolution or a higher resolution.
That's great.
Now the only thing was I've been a little busy, you know, with work and family. You know, it's been pretty hectic. I haven't had a chance to incorporate that FFmpeg setting into the Myth export settings. I was playing around with it, and it wasn't quite working correctly, so I'm still fiddling around with that. You know, I think I'm going to take that FFmpeg that Patrick Archibald sent me and try to set that up in Myth Export and use that. You know, so you can set up, you know, you'll have a user job that you can either set up to run automatically after a show's recorded, or you can go in and set it so that, you know, you just go in and say, okay, run this job to re-encode this recording to, you know, whatever setting you want to do it at. And you can also do that through the Myth web interface as well. So it's pretty nice. It's pretty nice. So I recommend check out Myth Export. And if I do get my setting perfect for my Android phone, I'll patch that on to John, and he'll put it into his the full configuration file so that everybody else doesn't have to figure it out. It'll be in there, and it'll be one of the choices that you can select right out of the box.
Right, yeah.
And that's that. Now, have you done any video for your phone? What do you got? You got a BlackBerry, right, Dan?
Yeah, I have a BlackBerry.
Does that do video?
That's from work. I haven't tried it. I found it lacks in a lot of areas, so I haven't tried to do anything intensive like that on that. It blows, the web browser blows up on anything Flash-based and whatnot, so, you know, like YouTube and all that is out of the question for me. So I don't know if it's something that my, you know, what they set up, you know, in my, because it's from my company, so if it's something that they set up to block a lot of that stuff. I haven't noticed any firewall things that prevent me from getting there. It's just that some of the settings seem to be kind of off, so I don't even use it for that. If I do need to do any of that, I just tether it to my Nokia N800. You know, with the Bluetooth modem and do it all on the N800.
Right, right. Yeah, the N800 does video back pretty well. You know, the N800, the N810, the Nokia devices, the internet tablets, they can do, you know, H.264 videos. They can also do XVIDs and DivXs, I think. I've done all different formats with that, and it seems to handle
pretty well. Yeah, and I worked with John a while back to get the right FFmpeg lines to do video for the N800. I still was tweaking some things, and I never actually got a chance to get back and finish it completely, because I did have some audio sync issues that I was running into. But otherwise, it was working pretty nicely. The video looked really, really nice, and I just needed to work out some of the audio sync stuff. It was something strange, but where it was having to two-pass, you know, something with the two-pass command wasn't working right. So it would do one pass and then do a second pass, and it should have cleaned that stuff up, but it didn't seem to be cleaning it up.
Yeah, when you do, like, video
reencoding. Just haven't had a chance to get back.
That's the thing. You got to find a little time to do that. Whenever you do, like, reencoding a video like that, two-pass tends to do, like, a better quality. You know, you won't have any, like, video ghosting or anything like that. You know, you won't have, like, audio sync issues. It just tends to make it a little better quality. It takes longer to do it, but it's definitely worth it. Also the Hopog PVR 1212, or the HD PVR as it's commonly known as, the sale price right now is around $200. I haven't seen it for cheaper since then. I think Amazon had it. Somebody posted. I've not seen it for anything cheaper than that, unfortunately. Now at CES, there was an announcement of Silicon Dust, the people to do the HD Home Run. Supposedly they were going to do a cable card version of the HD Home Run, and they announced it at CES. Now,
right.
As far as I know, that's only going to work on Windows. You know, we'll have to wait and see whether or not that'll work on Linux. You know, cable card on Linux doesn't seem to be happening. You know, and it's the DRM basically. They don't want to put an implementation on Linux, which is kind of unfortunate. But you know,
right.
And as far as I know, though, you know, conversations people I've heard that they say that cable card's kind of dying. It never really took off. You know, the cable companies, you know, supposedly. You know, they'll rent you, you know, cable cards, you know, for $4 or $5 a month. And, you know, you put it into your device and it's basically just like having, you know, tuner boxes without having the tuner boxes. And it's cheaper. But you hear hear stories of people doing this and, you know, your mileage varies depending upon who your provider is. Some people, you know, they say, yeah, you plug it in, it works great and whatnot. And other people have horror stories saying that, you know, it never works quite the way they advertise it to work, you know.
Yeah, and I think too the cable companies don't want to be supporting this. It's a pain for their installers to come in and put them in, I believe, because I don't think all the TV manufacturers are following any specific, you know, standard for these slots or anything like that. Yeah, sure, the interface for the card needs to be there, but I think that it's something that they don't want to. They don't want to be supporting. And that's what I've heard in the past, and I could be wrong. That may have changed, you know, here and there, but that's just something I heard. So.
Yeah, I mean, they want you to rent a box and charge you, you know, $10 or $12 or $15, mm-hmm. whatever your cable company charges a month. That's what they want. They want to get the most money out of you.
Sure, and I don't think you can do like any of like the on demand stuff as well. So they're losing out on money that way as well.
Yeah, they want you to get a box. You know, so that's that. I mean, and the satellite companies, they don't even do anything like that. You got to get a box for every TV. You have to have a separate box. Everything's encrypted with the satellite companies.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Joining us tonight, we got the Mythbuntu devs, Mario Limoncello and Nick Fox. Guys, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So Mario, you founded the Mythbuntu project. Can you take us back, you know, when you started it?
Yeah, so originally I was doing Myth TV on Gentoo for a couple of years. And when I switched over to Ubuntu, I found that there was a lot of lack of work of people doing Myth TV work there. And things didn't really work too well. So initially I tried to help out with the packaging scripts to make the packages work better out of the box, and then just found other deficiencies with integration and came up with the idea to go and start a project to have Myth TV on Ubuntu working out of the box right from a live CD.
I remember the first time I did an install on Myth TV and Ubuntu, and there was a document in the wiki, and you could pretty much get it going pretty easily with, you know, whatever version you happened to be running at the time. And I'm sure you had a large part in that. But what really has taken Mythbuntu forward for me has been the whole Control Center application. How long have you been working on that piece?
That's been ever since when we first started the project. Like 4 months in, somebody threw the idea out there that we should have a central little panel for everything, and then we've just been chugging forward with that. Nowadays, it's actually a pluggable architecture that you can go and write a new plugin for the Control Center and add it into the system later on if you'd like.
Yeah, that's been great, you know. That's what really sets Mythbuntu apart from the other Myth-specific Linux distribution, is the Control Center. You have everything in there.
Yeah, I think it's turned out great. And one of the authors of Jamu is working on a Control Center plugin, actually, to go and configure Jamu and Miro Bridge through the Control Center.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah, I haven't talked to him in a little bit, so I don't know where he's at with it, but hopefully before 10.04 is out, he'll have it finished up.
For anybody who's not familiar with it, can you just give us a little overview of some of the things that you could do in Control Center?
So you can go and start out with the Ubuntu box if you'd like, and you can add any Myth TV role to it. So if you want to make it a back-end or a back-end front-end or just a front-end, there's little radio buttons there that you click one of those options, and they'll set it all up for you. If you want to go and add drivers for your graphics card, it's got little buttons that pull up tools to add drivers into the system. if you want to configure Samba or NFS or any services. It's got other little knobs for those things.
And you try to stick with the currently offered tools for those things if they're available. For instance, like the hardware drivers, you're just basically launching the hardware drivers applet itself, correct?
Yeah, so if there's a tool available that we could take advantage of, we do. If not, then we've got custom stuff that we'll write our own tools for it.
Now, what is that mostly written in?
Yeah, we try to use any system.
Is that all Python or is it Bash?
I'm sorry, what
language is the control center written in?
It's all Python. And we try to use system methods whenever possible. So with 10.04, we're using something called AppDaemon that was introduced. It's the same stuff that's used for the Ubuntu Software Center.
Yeah,
the more we stick to standard APIs, the better we get along in the Ubuntu community.
It works really well. I mean, it's pretty impressive. You can go in there, you can set up, if you just want to do a back-end setup, you can do a back-end setup. If you want to do a combined box, you know, most people, the first time they do a MIT setup, you know, first time around, they usually do a combined back-end front-end type system. But as you get a little more comfortable with it, you know, you want to try, you know, a little more complex, you know, distributed setups. You might have a separate front-end only or two around the house, or you could do something like that Dan has done, where you have like a slave back-end, you know, to do secondary recordings and whatnot. And the control center makes it just so much easier.
Right.
Plus, it's nice being able to, you know, flip plugins on and off pretty easily.
Yeah, and we're just going to be driving forward as much as possible to improve it. So we're always open to new ideas for it.
Is there any plan with the control center to make it more remote friendly?
So that has been on the agenda for a while. We don't have a good way to do it yet, though.
Okay.
I think another option that was thrown out there was maybe switching it over to being web-based, because there's talk of the future versions of MythTV having a web-based MythTV setup instead. So Control Center could be another cool thing to do web-based.
Oh, yeah. That'd be neat.
So what are the big things that what happened with the last release? You guys were really cutting it close with 0.22 being released, and you wound up releasing before 0.22 was actually finalized. So you went out with the beta version, right?
So we went out with RC1. But we also have a service that we offer called Auto Builds, where we do builds of both 0.22 fixes and of trunk. And people can go to mythbuntu.org/auto-builds and hit a little button there that'll grab a deb, and it'll set up repos for all the 0.22 fixes builds or trunk builds. So if somebody comes across a problem that was fixed between RC1 and Gold, then they can go and use that instead.
That's what I wound up doing.
It's a nice, easy little piece to add to it. Pat and I both have that set up on all of our boxes, and you know we pull down the latest updates and whatnot, and everything has just been working, you know, phenomenally.
That's great.
Yeah, one of the questions that we had a few weeks back was, you know, a listener saying, you know, I have a Ubuntu set up. You know, I know it was beta. You know, should I just keep what comes down normally? Should I enable everything? And you explained it, and a little before me and Dan were talking about it, that you really should go in and enable the auto build service, select 0.22, and also select the PPAs too, especially if you wanted to get the Myth export working correctly. John, you know, when we spoke to him, John Babb, he had mentioned that, you know, you should have the PPA turned on, and the latest version of Myth export will install cleanly and work fine, and it does. I did that, and it works fine.
Something else that's nice that we added to the auto builds is the newer NVIDIA driver, the 190 driver. You can go and switch that if you have the auto builds turned on.
Maybe I'll try that. Because 185 was working pretty well for me.
I'm running it now because I have a 210 card in there, and I believe you need, with the 200 and 210, 220 thing up from there, you need to have the 190 driver.
For the next release of Ubuntu Mythbuntu, we're going to be having a more pluggable architecture for NVIDIA drivers, so you'll be able to switch between one driver to another without having to mess with extra repos or anything like that, too.
Now did John Avenel join you guys? Is he working with you guys? Because I know he backported VDPAU to 0.21, and I was running that for a while, and it seemed to work pretty well. And I know there was some talk of him joining up with you guys. Did that happen or no?
Yeah, so he uses the same packaging that we do for any of his builds, and he actually hosts one of the mirrors for auto builds now.
That's cool. So it's glad that you guys hooked up and working together.
Yeah, if you go and look, he's actually the maintainer now in Debian for libvdpau.
That's cool.
Or one of the maintainers, at least.
So Mario, how many guys you got working on the project now, Mythbuntu specifically? Like, how many like core contributors, and how many like, you know, just regular contributors?
I'd say it probably floats between 6 to 12 of us at any given time. just between guys that are working on themes, guys who work on packaging, guys who are just going and helping other users, or bug triage. There's all sorts of different things that we're all working on at different times. And one of our biggest pushes is to try to get more people to contribute. And so we have a whole contribution section set up on our mythbump2.org website, if you click on the resources link.
Yeah, I was checking that out the other day, actually, and there are, you know, quite a few areas where you guys are looking for people to help out. So I'd you know, recommend to anybody who's out there and using and following the mythbump2 project to go and check out that, see if there's anything you can offer up to help out.
Yeah, on the Lost episode, Nick and John had mentioned that you guys are looking to clean up the wikis that are currently part of the regular Ubuntu wiki and try to update that a little bit, right?
Right. Yeah, maybe Nick can speak a little bit more to that.
I'm sorry, I was multitasking. Please repeat. You're going to have to edit this.
We were just talking about cleaning up of the...
We were just asking you to talk about some of the wiki cleanup that you were talking about in the episode that ended up being lost.
Well, we're currently trying our best to redocument, to bring everything up to date and move everything over from the Ubuntu wikis into a wiki on our own site to have a more unified contribution point of documentation. While we're having that effort on our own, we've also enabled OpenID support on our site as an upgrade to try and help bring in some contributors from the Ubuntu community that use Mythbuntu to do documentation and try and get our documentation caught back up to current release so it's more maintainable going forward as well.
Yeah, it must be crazy, you know, all these releases come out every 6 months of Ubuntu, and you guys pretty much mirror the regular Ubuntu releases. You know, the documentation usually is the thing that tends to, you know, drag behind everything else. You know, development's happening so fast. You know, usually the documentation's like the afterthought. It's only normal, you know?
Well, especially with how much time we have to spend on testing for every cycle. Just between every little alpha that comes out, there's last-minute things that need to be fixed, that code changes in Ubuntu that affects us, or code that we didn't expect would affect us changes, and all sorts of little problems.
So how's the release?
How do you go about testing all of that? I mean, as they push things down, I assume it takes quite a while to rebuild, right? For one of either a package to be rebuilt, or if you're just trying to test out to say maybe a certain line in the what is it, Subversion repository out there, what is testing? What kind of testing is involved with that?
So the biggest testing that we do between our different alphas and RCs and whatnot is more our live CD testing and installation testing, because code doesn't change that much from build to build for MythTV itself. But the stuff that we're so dependent on within Ubuntu is stuff like Ubiquiti and the installer, and other little APIs related to that. So we'll have daily live builds done of our live CD that you can go and download the ISO and throw it into a virtual machine or on some real hardware and see exactly what kind of issues people are going to run into when they try to install.
Gotcha.
And when it comes to RC time, we can't have enough testers at that point to make sure that we're catching every little thing.
So what's the mechanism that you do, the virtual machine mechanism? I had a conversation on the tech show, and someone had mentioned the testing mechanism that you can do to try out the latest release candidate or beta of Ubuntu while it's still in the development cycle. There's an easy mechanism to do that, right? You go in through one of the PPA repos, and there's a package to enable that, and then you can install.
Oh, you're talking about Test Drive.
Yeah, Test Drive, that's it.
Is that correct?
Yeah, Test Drive. A lot of people like that.
Yeah, I believe Dustin Kirkland just created that within the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, that's really good. It's a nice way of testing something.
And I haven't used it myself, but it's supposed to work very well for testing out new releases. I just manually go and grab ISOs myself and burn them to USB keys.
I'm gonna try that out. Because how far along are you guys in the next release cycle?
So we're at Alpha 2 right now. I think release isn't going to be until April or so. And we'll probably be upgrading to a 0.23-based build before feature freeze.
That's got to be tough. You know, I know 22 took about 18 months to get up and running. But 23, they seem to be wanted to do it by March, right? Sometime in March, I think they were talking.
I think so.
Yeah. The thing I like about the latest Mythbuntu is the default Mythbuntu theme. It looks great. Whoever did that did a great job.
Yes, so we've had some artwork guys who have been putting overtime in working on that stuff, and I think that they did a phenomenal job with it. And they're currently working on an update to our website, which hopefully we'll have ready to go by the time the next release comes out.
Yeah, I know one of the guys working on that.
A lot more of what the theme is like.
I saw a little preview of that, and it looks great. It's gonna be fantastic once it finally comes out and it goes live on the website. It'll look really nice. So
the theme that we have, the Mythbuntu MythTV theme, actually made it upstream as well. So anybody who's not running Mythbuntu can still go and use that theme.
That's great, because it's a really nice theme. Speaking of themes, I know with 23, the Myth devs, they're talking about doing a theme contest. So that's hopefully they can get, you know, 2, 3, 4 new really nice themes into 023. I think that's their goal, and it's really nice, the whole new Myth UI library and the whole interface. It looks really nice what they've done.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it was definitely due for a refresh, the interface.
Yeah, definitely taking it forward.
So what are some of the other things, Mara, that you guys are looking to do for the next release? Is there anything specific, or just general improvement, or just keeping everything up to date and in sync?
So there's been a lot of back-end code changes that I've been going through, at least myself, to try to make things more pluggable in terms of our installer. Users probably won't see a lot of difference, but the maintainability of our code will be much, much better. And we're going to have a couple of new plugins we might be introducing into the Control Center that we've thrown around ideas for. But other than that, it shouldn't be many visible changes to the users.
I guess the hardest thing that you probably hear about and the rest of the devs hear about is when people install Mythbuntu, is they might run into a hardware issue that's very specific to the piece of hardware that they have. I mean, you can't test on every single piece of hardware that's out there. So how do you attack that whole notion? You try to go for like the low hanging fruit, and you know that 85% of everybody else uses. And, you know, and then you'll hear about the,
So we try to have common hardware for all of ourselves, for each of the developers, and test with that common hardware. And if people are going to have issues with other hardware, they will file bugs, and they will file lots of bugs. So whenever those bugs come up, we have a framework in Ubuntu and Mythbuntu called AppWort. And AppWort can go and grab all sorts of useful logs related to issues when they come up. So if a user gets a seg fault, they can go and grab all the backend logs, go and do a backtrace, install the debug symbols, and things like that, so we can actually take those logs and debug symbols and turn them into something useful that we could send upstream or fix ourselves.
And
do you post out there anywhere the common hardware that you guys use to do all your testing on, so that maybe if somebody even just starting out wants to take a look at some hardware, they could look at that and say, oh, we know the devs are using this hardware, so this should work for us.
You know, I don't think that we do that right now, but that would be a great idea for us to do.
Kind of have like a baseline hardware.
I'll take that note back, and we could talk to our developers about it.
You know, one of the big things for anybody who uses MythTV, I tell them, you know, go look and see what other people are using hardware-wise, and go with stuff that's standardized. I know what Lynn has, we know, which used to be called NotMyth, on his forum, he has like a whole hardware-type thing of... And he has like three levels of support. Tier one is stuff that works out of the box, no problems. Tier two is like stuff that like works, you know, but you have to fiddle with it. And then like the tier three stuff is what you avoid completely. And I tell people to look at that, you know, thread, those threads. Also the MythTV users mailing list is another good source, you know. But the whole thing with the mailing list, I find, is that, you know, topics come up for discussion, you know, people make good points and everything, and then they kind of get lost down the line, you know. Whereas something like a wiki is a little more formalized and maintainable, you know?
So the problem with the way that we do things, it's such a frequent release cycle that even if we did have information saying that this hardware works great, this hardware doesn't, it's going to be invalid within 5-6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the best we could do is maybe mention the hardware that we all own ourselves and that we know will continue to work great. And then if you go outside that, then you're on your own.
I think even there's some sticky threads on the Ubuntu forums under Mythbuntu specifically that have some polls about, like, you know, hardware that works and doesn't work, and they're usually something that pops up each time an upgrade rolls around that people can post, you know, about their hardware issues and whatnot.
Yeah, that was an idea that we had when we first opened up those forums. I think it just turned into a really, really large thread of people who say, this is what my hardware is, though.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to go through and wade through it.
Yeah, I have to say the Mythbuntu install is very well done. You go in there, you can select your remotes. There's a whole nice selection of stuff to pull down from. It seems like you guys are hitting all the mainly supported devices. that are out there most people are using. And it's pretty easy to get going.
Yeah, that's what the goal is with it right now.
You know, going back, you know, doing, I remember my first build that I did with Myth. It literally took like days to get everything working correctly. And then now with, you know, Mythbuntu and other Myth-specific Linux distros, you're up and running like within like an hour or two, you know?
Yeah, I think I timed the quickest that I've done an install from nothing to fully set up, ready to go, and it was like 35 minutes.
Yeah.
I was seeing that with the Xeon box I just built. I reinstalled it a number of times when I was fiddling through wireless issues, but now it's all good.
So Mario and Nick, well,
I'm kind of curious, how does the wireless work over for Myth TV, like HD content?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
How does the wireless work when you're dealing with HD content?
Surprisingly well. I abandoned using an internal card altogether and actually went with a wireless N bridge. It's actually from TrendNet. It's a wireless N. It can be an access point, it can be a wireless distribution point, or it can be a wireless bridge. And my router is also a wireless N router from TrendNet. And it I notice about 20 minutes in, I get a slight stutter. You know, I think it's almost like with some buffering that's taking place with the stream, but otherwise, it comes across crystal clear. So I've only noticed those slight little hiccups periodically, but other than that, it comes across very nicely.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, I'm
actually considering setting up a couple of those other points, you know, throughout the house, even though it's a small house. I live in a townhouse, but I have a lot of interference from neighbors, and if I can boost that signal, you know, to the rest of my house and have it be strong enough, then I shouldn't have a lot of those issues anymore. I don't believe so.
Yeah, I have network cable for going upstairs.
It'd also be nice to switch over to a 5 gigahertz band if I could, but I have other devices that are dependent on a 2.4, so I'm stuck with that for now.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to lay cable when you're doing new construction, but if you're like in an existing home, it's sometimes not doable. And then, you know, you get into the whole thing of popping holes through the walls. Your wife might not like that.
Yeah, I don't mind doing the drywall and all that stuff, but I didn't want to go start ripping apart a lot of that stuff. It's still too new down here to be ripped open.
Yeah, so I'm glad to hear that, you know, you can do it through wireless. That's good to know. So Mario and Nick, can you give us like what kind of setups you guys do? What do you have as far as, you know, main system, back end, front ends, whatnot?
Sure. So I've actually gone through lots of different setups, and I'm at a much simpler one nowadays. I currently just have a single back-end front-end machine with 1.5 terabytes, and I use an HD Home Run and an internal HD 5000, and I only do over-the-air recording. I ditched my cable after I got really pissed off at Time Warner.
What did they do?
They took away my FireWire.
Yeah. It's not so bad now anymore with the HD PVRs, and I was a big FireWire user for a long time, and with the last couple of releases, you know, I was getting far too many, you know, instances where it wasn't changing channels appropriately, or it wouldn't change channel at all, you know, that type of stuff, and even the recordings were sometimes half complete. Now my STB is a couple years old now, and they do have a newer version, so I didn't know if maybe upgrading that would have solved a lot of that, but I ended up getting an HD PVR and that I said, well, honing connections on the back there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of a good thing though that I ditched the cable. I realized I was watching too much TV anyway, so
yeah.
Yeah, we talked to some people, and some people, like, they go crazy with the recordings. But it's nice. Like, you know, I have an HD Home Run that I do the unencrypted cable channels over, and then I also have the HD PVR that I record off my cable box. And I think that's, like, really, really a nice setup. I'm really loving it. I get the best of both worlds with that. In my setup, I have one master front.
Yeah, that's my back-end front-end machine. And I was going to mention, I have about 5 different laptops around my condo here that I all have Myth Run on. So depending on where I'm at in the condo, I'll be running on one of those at any given time.
And how about you, Nick? What kind of setup you got?
Well, I've got a front-end back-end machine with a secondary back-end. Actually, 2 secondary back-ends, but one of them is just a VM I use for screencasting. I'm down to just a single analog cable box that I use. Everything else is digital. And I use the HD Home Run as well for my unencrypted cable channels with multi-record. I've got an HD PVR that I'm using to capture from a digital box, and I'm controlling the digital box FireWire. And I've got, I also have an HVR 1600 that I'm using to capture unencrypted CLAM as well. So I've got a lot of recordings right now, somewhere in the ballpark of 2.25 terabytes.
Wow.
Yeah, a terabyte isn't as much as it used to be.
How's the FireWire changing? Yeah, how's the FireWire changing with those? I know Pat, you're doing this as well with the FireWire to the STV doing for, using the output as from the HD PVR.
Yeah, I'm doing FireWire channel changing.
The FireWire channel changing is working pretty well for me. I really have no issues there. It just works.
Well, what kind of box are you using, Nick?
I have no idea what the set-top box is. It's not a Moto. It's some generic box that my local crappy cable provider.
Maybe a Scientific uses. Atlanta, maybe.
No, it's not even that.
No.
I'd have to go look it up to tell you what it is. It's a completely unbranded box.
So do you use the standard changer script that's out there?
The standard 6200 channel changer script changes channels on the FireWire, no problem. Which was...
Oh, okay.
I just totally tried it out of luck, so...
Well, the one thing I ran into with that is that it doesn't support the, you know, switching to channels over 1,000. And recently, our cable provider here, it's called RCN, they switched all of our channels up into the 1,000 range, and I couldn't use it anymore to switch to, say, like 1,006, which is our local ABC channel. It would always just drop off the 1 and knock it back to just channel 6.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I have the newer box that they have. It's like the Motorola DCX3200. And I, for the most part, it works pretty well. With the FireWire changing channel, I think I have like a failure rate of maybe 1 out of 20. It accidentally goes to like one of those audio channels and it just stops recording. But, you know, I also have the HD Home Run. And for like any of the network shows, that's what I use. You know, I use the HD PVR for like all the other channels that are encrypted off the cable box, and it mostly works. I'm pretty happy with it. One of the things I wanted to ask you guys was, I know with the HD PVR, the IR piece, I know that was being worked on by the regular Myth developers. I know Jared Wilson had got it basically working like back in, I think, September or October. And I think he was working to get that code upstream. And I know he's one of the guys who works on Mythora. And I was wondering if you guys had any input on as far as the IR transmitting on the HD PVR, whether you guys are working on that or you're just going to wait for that to come downstream from those guys.
So there's a Lurk patch set that has to be applied for it. And it's been on my to-do list to go and look at that and see if we can pull it in. So hopefully I'll get that done before the kernel freeze happens for Ubuntu.
That would be much appreciated. I think a lot of people have been asking for that. Well, I want to thank you guys. You guys do a great job. Mythbuntu is phenomenal. It's really, really nice.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Nick, do you want to mention your company there?
Oh, sure. I've got a small startup company where I'm going to be building Mythbuntu-based pre-built, basically PVRs. Going to be pretty well based on hardware that I worked with in the past and have well tested over the last year with Mythbuntu and know that it will work out of the box. So it's easy to support, easy to use, set up and ready to go kind of thing. It's at Fox Media Systems with an S.com. And the release date on those is hopefully going to happen very shortly, and the announcement will come for that. Just keep watching for it.
Cool. Well, guys, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and keep up the good work. And if anybody wants to help contribute, you know, definitely go check out the wiki and see where you guys can help. You know, you don't have to be a coder; you can be a documenter. You know, if you're an experienced Myth user and you've done different configurations and setups and different hardware, I'm sure these guys will be willing to, you know, take input and any how-tos and whatnot. They're very helpful. I mean, if you could save somebody some grief going through a setup, it goes a long way, I think.
Indeed. Thank you very much for having us on here.
Guys, anytime.
Sure, and if you guys want to come back anytime, make any announcements, just let us know, and we'll be glad to have you back on.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Have a good night.
Having us on. Yep.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Alrighty. Well, that was awfully nice of those guys to come and talk to us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was. It was.
It's a lot of work, you know. An open source project is a ton of work, man. And those guys, you know, they bust their asses doing this stuff. And I don't think a lot of people appreciate what they all do. You know, and they're volunteers, you know, for the most part. And it's really awesome that they do this stuff. You know, and people should.
Yeah, it's a great project. You and I both have been using it now for a number of the last releases that have been out, and we've both been very happy with it.
Yeah, it's quality stuff, man. They do a great job, and I highly recommend Mythbuntu for people. You know, people who are, you know, new to Myth and people who aren't new to Myth. I've been playing around with Myth for a while now, and I really like it a lot.
And just, with the types of setups that you can do with it, I mean, I'm an example of that with setting up, you know, the master backend that just sits hidden away somewhere and divvies out all the jobs, all the places, streams all the content places. I mean, you can really go crazy with what you want to do. I mean, I plan on building yet one more, at least for this house here, and putting it, you know, up on our third floor there, and in our bedroom, so that we can get access to this content out there as well. So, I mean, you can really do, you know, whatever you can imagine with it. So, I mean, they make it very easy to get things set up and running.
The control center is really awesome. I mean, you can go in and just do a front end setup, on, like on, you know, one of these Ion boxes, you know, and it's a snap, really, what you can do with it and how fast you can do it. They're taking the hard work out of it and making it easier for people to use it and set it up. And for that, you got to commit.
Yep, definitely.
Definitely. So I think we're going to wrap it up. Dan, do you have anything that like to add before we say goodnight?
No, I think we covered it.
Yeah, we got good news, man. The recording's here. I see it in front of me, so that's not going to be an issue.
That's great. Hey, we don't want to have any of those missed recordings like last week.
yeah. Hopefully, I pick up my TV in the next week or two, so I'm sure I'll be talking about that the next episode.
That'll be awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I can't wait to get everything all together and get it all set up and working. I'm looking forward to it. Everybody, thanks for taking the time to listen, and we will talk to you next time.
I think we should also include here, you know, shoot us any feedback. You know, I can be reached on Identica and Twitter and on Facebook and whatnot. And, you know, Pat, the same. Come to our website. Check it out. And, you know, that's where you can get all of our shows and get in contact with us. And
yes.
Also, there's a link to our forums there and any of our previous screencasts.
Yep. And if you have hate mail, send it to Dan Fry.
Yeah. Can I forward that over to Link as well?
Yeah, CC Link.
That's what most other shows do.
Yeah. Link's a busy guy. We don't need the ball app.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, everybody, thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space, somewhere else in time.
The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the horizon of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.